Please note that the opinions and perspectives shared on the Real Pharma podcast by Nari O and Ian Wendt are their own. These views do not represent the positions, strategies, or opinions of their employers or any other organizations with which they may be affiliated. Now on with the show.
I don't think we're going to be using much human data in the future. I think most data that we will be using is synthetic or digital twin data. I really don't think humans and human data will be used. And that makes a lot of sense for our industry to use synthetic data because, you know, you've got all the elements that make it as real as if it is a human, but it's not actually anyone. It's just fake data. And if that fake data is good enough, which it is now, even the FDA are approving it for synthetic data, then we don't need to use humans and it gets rid of all of this issue.
This is Real Pharma, your podcast for real conversations with pharma pathfinders. In every episode, you will hear from an industry insider who has a story to share that goes beyond the headlines. No spin, no sacred cows, no hidden agendas, just stories and the people behind them. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Nari O and Ian Wendt.
Welcome back to another episode of the Real Pharma Podcast, where we dive deep into the innovations shaping the future of healthcare. I'm your host, Nari O, joined by my co-host, the sagacious Ian Wendt. And today we're really thrilled to have a truly exceptional guest with us, Dr. Andre Bates, a pioneering force in the realm of artificial intelligence within the pharmaceutical industry. Andre is the founder, chairman, and CEO of Eulerys, a company that has been at the forefront of integrating AI to transform the biopharma landscape since 2003. Under her leadership, Eulerys has not only achieved significant growth, but has also become a beacon of innovation, offering groundbreaking AI solutions that enhance efficiency and skyrocket revenues for top pharma companies across the globe. From New York to Tokyo, London to Hong Kong, Andre's strategic vision has driven Eulerys to excellence with a commitment to on-time project completions and a customer-centric approach that is second to none. A thought leader and a sought-after speaker, Andre has reshaped how the industry sees the untapped potential of data analysis through AI. Andre is also a founding member of CHIEF, a network dedicated to elevating women into positions of power and keeping them there, reflecting her passion for leadership and empowerment. Today, we're set to unpack Andre's insights on the evolving role of AI in pharma, explore the future of healthcare innovation, and discuss her advocacy for women in leadership. Andre, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for joining us.
Great to have you here. So Andre, you have vast experience in healthcare, broadly speaking. You have a PhD in neuroscience. You worked on the agency side in medical advertising and communications, digital marketing, and you started working in AI at a time when people probably mostly didn't even know what AI was, 2003, and especially with a focus on pharma. Can you tell us a little bit more about how did you get to start Eulerys? And what was the motivation behind that at such an early time?
Well, it was very simple. A lot of my pharma clients at the time, when I would ask them about their marketing and which channels were providing what kind of return on investment, because I was really into return on investment, read a lot of papers on it, they didn't know and they couldn't measure it very well. And so I thought, okay, well, that's something that we can solve with math for sure. So that's really, it was really trying to solve that challenge of what return am I getting from different channels, different messages, different, you know, execution, and how can I change that? And so when I started, I wasn't thinking AI, I was thinking math. But what I quickly realized is that we needed a nonlinear math. So most math is linear, like statistics. And because the relationships between the messaging and the channels and even execution, all of these things play a role in what sales you get. And so they're quite complex relationships. And that's really when I went, so during my PhD, my lab was using machine learning to validate our neurological theories. And so when I started going, we need a nonlinear math, I suddenly remembered, machine learning, that's what we can use. So we built a machine learning platform that basically analyzed data and could predict pharmaceutical brand market share growth or decline and by how much and why, more importantly, what they were doing that needed changing in terms of all of those different components and like the messaging and the sales force and the different marketing channels. And also, because we analyzed all the brands in a category, we could see how much market share was essentially up for grabs in that category. And so we could say, this is where you're going now. You could go higher because there's actually a bit in flux from these different brands. But to do that, this is what you're going to have to change. So we really started there. But then we got into lots of other things, from finding rare disease patients to lots of different things. But that's how it started.
Thinking back to the early 2000s, to me, as kind of an outsider to the technology world, the buzzwords seemed to be machine learning and big data, right? With the two big areas of focus that I heard being brought up quite a lot. Now, a lot of that, I think, has just been replaced with this more ubiquitous term of AI generally. And I wonder, you know, about that evolution. Is AI just kind of a rebranding or a better way to describe this? Did we hit some inflection point where machine learning became now AI and those are different things? I just want to make sure we're all understanding the terminology correctly, because certainly for me and others listening, we may not all be familiar with it.
I can explain the general concept of AI and the different types of things. So, for example, artificial intelligence is kind of the umbrella term. It's really that intersection between math and computing, which all AI is. And it's really aiming to be as much like the brain, neuro-ish, as it can be. So, you know, when we're learning new skills as a brain, a human brain, we are forming more dendritic pathways, and it makes the more you practice, the easier it becomes. Whereas with AI, it's all about the data, and the more data that comes in, the easier, you know, the more accurate it becomes. And so machine learning is a subtype of AI, and there's lots of subtypes of machine learning. So you've got artificial neural networks and decision trees and so on. And then underneath those, there's subtypes. So artificial neural networks, underneath that is deep learning, underneath that is generative AI. So they're all just different types. And then, of course, we've got natural language processing. We've got agents, and, you know, agents is a big thing these days. And then you've got intelligent agents, utility-based agents, different types of agents. So they're all forms of AI, but they all have different kind of application. And the way you choose which, well, the data scientist chooses, it's really dependent on what data you're using and what the problem you're trying to solve is. And then they can pull it, go into their toolbox and go, well, you know, for example, if it's a image problem, usually for images, deep learning is really good. If it's a language problem, you're going to have some kind of natural language processing involved if you want it to understand contextually, et cetera. So it's just different horses for different courses, but they're all different forms of AI.
So Andre, I mean, you were truly pioneering with how you applied AI back in 2003, early 2000s. But I would argue that the challenges that you were trying to address then are still challenges we have today. I think pharma companies are still struggling with understanding ROI and what is the best tool for a particular purpose and how do you measure it and then act on the insights that you gain.
Yeah, I thought that was solved. So I moved on to the next thing.
Exactly. I know you have so many different applications that you're looking into, but yeah. Going back to where you started with really the focus on the commercial part of pharma, how were your ideas received by your clients initially? And did people really understand what you're trying to do? And can you talk us through the evolution of that particular sector over the next decades or so?
Yeah. So in those days, when I first started talking about machine learning and AI, people would say to me, but isn't that robots? What's that got to do with pharma? And then I remember I was doing a project for AstraZeneca and I was explaining it to the client. And then they went, this is so confusing, but it works. So then they were explaining it to their team as, it's essentially really clever math and computing. And I thought, well, that's a nice, easy way to explain it. So we kind of stopped talking about AI per se because no one understood the concept. In fact, I was at a dinner party and I said to someone asked me what I did and I said, I work in AI. And they said, oh, that's very controversial. And I said, really, why? And they said, well, artificial insemination.
That's great.
And I thought, okay, so really not well known.
Yeah, exactly.
So the big issue we had then, and that I can tell you how we solved it, but was data. And data is always the issue. And so we were trying to find good data to do our algorithms on. And in the end, we collected the data ourselves. So we used a variety of techniques, basically market research kind of chart pool, but modified, and got all this data from doctors. We got data on marketing. So we did all sorts of questions to doctors, a lot of market research data. And then we supplemented that. So we still had a few good data sources. Sonet was in Japan then, and they were selling doctor data. We had a few different sources, but a lot of it was collected. And even today, outside the US, it's not that easy to get the EHR data. So we still do different techniques, market researchy kind of techniques to collect data still. But as the years came on, you know, in 2009, data.gov started. And then it was about 2013, healthcaredata.gov. So we started to get more and more huge data sets. You know, I think there's 115 million big data sets there. And those data sets are really interesting. So, for example, we can use data from data.gov to find undiagnosed ADHD adults, for example. All sorts of things. That data is very rich when you triangulate it for lots of different uses. And then in 2017, we got the pinnacle point where the data generated in 2017, just in that year, was bigger than the rest of all recorded history of humanity's data. And that's when things just exploded, because then every year it was even more. And so we started to get to this point where there was just so much data we could use. Well, actually, 2014 was another pinnacle year, because that's when generative AI was invented. Would you like me to explain what generative AI, how it started?
Yeah, please do.
So there was this British data scientist called Ian Goodfellow, and he had an algorithm, an AI algorithm, machine learning one, which he was using to train to distinguish between real data and fake data. So he was thinking of things like real news, fake news kind of things. His algorithm was so good, he wanted to make it even better. So he thought, I'm going to create a generator using neural networks to take bits of the real data and generate new data that's so real, it's really difficult for anything to tell the difference. And that was called a generative adversarial network. And that was really the first generative AI. And we still use generative adversarial networks today. There's lots of different types of generative AI now. There's transformer-based models, as you know. There's the GAN, generative adversarial networks. We've got diffusion models, variational autoencoders, unimodal. There's so many different neural radiance fields, et cetera. So there's so many different models, but that's how it started. And then the reason it's become a lot more powerful now is, particularly since the human genome was mapped, that really made a big difference for AI and drug discovery. But on top of that, our computing power, you know, now we've got supercomputing and quantum computing. And so that means before we didn't have that ability to do huge R&D and discovery kind of projects, but now we can use generative AI really effectively for things like that. So now AI is designing drug molecules. If you look at AstraZeneca's pipeline now, it's mostly AI. Takeda had bought a drug that was basically generated in 6 months with a startup with AI. I can talk about this later, but I can tell you my vision of the future, and part of it is that we will basically be able to get a drug from bench to market, or at least to the IND, to the marketing application, sorry, within a year or two. You know, it's not going to be 10 years in the future.
So we'll definitely have to talk about that later in a lot of detail, because, okay, of course, this is one of the big areas where people in pharma hope to see major development and major improvement.
There's a lot there.
Yeah. I wanted to quickly go back to something you said earlier that was kind of funny, which is your early client said, it's very complicated, but it works. So to a degree,
yes,
right? Maybe that's enough. No, not everybody needs to be an expert in AI, but we need to understand what is our goal and how can AI help us get there. And you said we have much more data, but at the end of the day, garbage in, garbage out, the better your data is going in, the better the outcomes. Can you give us a concrete example of how in the commercial world, the application of AI really helped get to really good results that the clients were hoping for?
Absolutely. Which business unit would you like me to look at? Because we work throughout the value chain. So name a business unit, I can tell you how we're using AI in that space.
Maybe we can do something for commercial insights and analytics, and then maybe something that's a little bit different, which is market access.
Market access, yeah. Okay, I can do both of those. Market access, huge advantages to AI. There's so many different ways you can use it. But for example, value pricing. for launch, but also for LOE. You know, I seem to see companies, particularly now that we've got this patent cliff coming up, suddenly scrambling and looking at all their pricing for LOE. But we know it's so far in advance. And actually, when you launch the product, you could actually be doing both. You know, you could be doing your value pricing for both in a way. But you can do the same kind of value pricing for launch with AI, but much, much stronger, because you've got over 650 huge databases with HTA decisions, reimbursement, claims data, all this different data that's out there. And actually, it's very similar to the way that Airbnb do it. So they've got a pricing algorithm that basically, when someone puts a property on their website, the algorithm trawls the internet and finds any other properties in those areas. And then it calculates, okay, based on what they're charging, these hotels, these properties, what is going to be the optimal price that is going to give us the highest profit and the highest occupancy? So you could basically price it higher than that and you would have more profit per person, but you wouldn't have as many people. And conversely, you could price it lower. But there's this sweet spot in the middle. And we can do that with pharma pricing. You know, you can actually create that value price and the value narrative, the whole story can be created with AI. So that's one area. Another one we did for a big pharma company many years ago now was fast reimbursement. So they were basically, once the drug's approved, then they had to go and go for reimbursement. And so we did it in Europe where EMA had approved and then they had to go to the different country regulatory bodies for reimbursement. And actually, we can improve that process quite a lot by at least 6 weeks to get a drug to market, even though it doesn't sound like much. But, you know, if we've got a drug that's 9 million a day, it makes you something.
That is a lot. Absolutely.
But it's really because you can look at what their issues are. So we've done it in the US too with FDA. Once FDA is approved, you look at the different formularies. So then you can basically look at what's going on around that, either NICE in England, for example, or a particular formulary. And if you know who's on the formulary committee or who's on the decision committee, you can actually also cyberstalk them a little bit and get data on them and things they're talking about online. And you can start to craft the dossiers with the right weighting. So we, in that one, we were looking at all of the previous decisions. For example, if I just take an example of NICE, all the previous decisions, which ones took a long time, which ones didn't, and what the differences were. And from that, you can start to get an idea of what should be weighted in this dossier. Obviously, price is an important one and you want to get your value price right. But it might be this body here are more interested in more evidence. This one's more interested in something else. And then also getting the language to the sort of language that resonates with them. So you can actually create these dossiers that are a lot more powerful. They still need a human to go through, because although they are grammatically correct, sometimes sentences sound a little bit strange. So you get a human to go through it, but then it's just a matter, like most AI, like medical affairs, regulatory, all of these, you know, you can automate a lot of the processes, but then you're getting a human to check it.
I just wanted to add, or just a kind of a drill in a little bit deeper on that, because one of the questions that comes to mind to hear you describe the market access examples, which were really interesting to think about, does that help inform potentially evidence generation? Because you kind of understand how to weight your dossier based on evidence you have today. But are you able to model different scenarios of evidence you might generate and look at the downstream effects in terms of access and reimbursement? Has anybody done that?
Yeah, you can do that. Absolutely. You can also create a global value dossier with AI. Because, you know, although they vary from company to company, within the company, they have quite standard sections. And so you can get AI to basically be trawling the internet, trawling all the publication databases, and actually writing the summaries to put into the different sections. So you can actually generate your dossiers that way from the literature and from all the same data sources that you would be using as a human to do it. And you can, the great thing about using AI to do that is you can make it a living document. So, you know, it can keep being updated.
That's amazing.
It is. It's definitely a brave new world, because this goes beyond, I think, what most companies are considering for AI usage. So maybe we can start a little bit earlier in the life cycle. Let's back off a little bit.
Yeah.
So let's start very early on, drug discovery.
Okay.
We've heard a lot in the media about the possible applications of AI, but I think, again, Andre, you're painting a much broader picture. What have you seen, or what do you envision? You just mentioned extreme time savings, which any company would really love. How does that come together in the different parts of drug discovery?
I think a good example is what's been done already. And if you think back to COVID, and in, you know, that was 4 years ago now, one of the problems was we had to get things done quickly because it was an epidemic. So I think it was Benevolent AI decided that they were going to use AI to look at all the existing FDA-approved drugs to see which drugs would be likely to be effective against COVID. And they came up with the tenosynovir. And then, no, that was Diagen. Diagen did that. And then Benevolent AI did the same thing, and they came up with baricitinib. So they both used an AI approach, a Gen AI approach, and came up with different drugs. Both of those drugs went into clinical trials. Both of those drugs were found to be effective against COVID. So they would block the SARS-CoV protein and stop it from replicating. What I found even more interesting, because I went back and looked at it about a year or so ago, when used in combination, because I was just checking, you know, did they pan out? And they did. But when used in combination, the efficacy was even stronger when they used those two drugs together. And they were both found literally within a week with AI. And then there were two other companies. In Silico did something very interesting. So they said, okay, we're not going to look at existing drugs. We're going to create new molecules. And they actually came up with 10,000 molecules that had potential. They filtered it down to 100 molecules in 4 days. So that was using, again, Gen AI, because the thing is with AI, you've got all these omics databases and you've got the human genome, and you've got all these different things. That's what AI excels at, is going through huge amounts of data to make decisions on things. So that whole area, and there's two other companies, Iktos and SRI Biosciences. One of them have a synthetic chemistry platform with deep learning, which basically they can design the drug. One of them can design the drug and the other one can basically make it with the synthetic chemistry. So they joined forces and were doing some things together as well. And they did it, I think, in 2 weeks. So you can see that we're actually getting results from those that actually panned out in clinical trials super, super fast. So that's examples in discovery. Now, clinical trials is an area that I think has got huge things happening, has been for the last 2 years. So if we think about, do you know what synthetic data is and digital twin data?
Kind of.
No, I don't.
Okay. So synthetic data is what was generated with that generative adversarial network. So it's basically taking elements of real data or real humans and creating new data or new human data. So you can actually generate new patients that don't exist. So that's now being used a lot in clinical trials where we can actually test things with synthetic data and digital twins. And I'll tell you about digital twins in a moment. So synthetic data is very interesting. And nowadays, a lot of the phase three control arms are synthetic data. And the FDA approved using digital twins and synthetic data in, I think it was about October 22. And so now we have drugs that are going through that are doing that. And I'll just quickly explain digital twins. So a digital twin is a different thing again. A digital twin is a digital replica of something, in our case, humans. But it started with NASA in the 60s. So they wanted to create a digital replica of the space station so that all the things that were going, you know, the rockets going up into space. So if something went wrong, they could replicate the problem on Earth and send up a fix. Then General Electric Electric in the 70s did the same thing with their power plants. Now, for at least a decade in medicine, we've had digital twins of organs. So we've had digital twins of hearts, digital twins of pancreas. But now the research in whole body digital twins is quite astounding and lots of really good progress. So we now have drugs coming through that have had digital twins instead of animal testing. So phase one is digital twin. Digital twin instead of phase two, no humans. And phase three, they have got humans in the control, the test arm, but the control arm is synthetic data. So the combination of, you know, just in these two bits, discovery and clinical trials, the combination of actually using AI to discover the drug and then to just speed through clinical trials in, you know, a month, a week, whatever, it's got huge implications for us. At the moment, we still have that phase three trial happening with humans. I get a lot of flack when I say this, but I really don't believe humans will be in the loop eventually. It sounds crazy, I know, but I do think we will get to that point at some point because the AI is getting so good at mimicking the human body. And so that's fascinating and amazing. And I think that's going to revolutionize a lot. But even if we didn't get to the point where we still had humans, we're at that point now where we don't need them in every phase. We only need them in the last phase. So that's already cutting down time dramatically. So I think that's huge. Then if we go to regulatory, you know, the kinds of things that we do in regulatory and medical affairs, mostly are about efficiency. So, for example, in regulatory, we had a project a few years ago where the client had all these dossiers and then the guidance would come in. They were working globally. So the guidance would come in from World Health and from ASEAN and all these different places. And the regulatory people had to check their dossier, check this huge, huge guidance documents, and then go back to the dossier and highlight where changes had to be made. Whereas we automated that process. So basically the AI would read the dossier, read the guidance, highlight the places within the document that needed to be changed. And they got us to classify the changes into minor, moderate, and major, and then make suggestions as to what to change. So that's huge efficiencies. Medical affairs, same. You know, with medical affairs, you can get over 1,000% increase in productivity just from implementing AI. If you think about things like, let me give an example, literature monitoring and medico-legal reviews. We're automating medico-legal reviews so that instead of someone spending months to go through a document and get it back, it can be done in an hour. And then the medico-legal reviewer just checks the write-up because it all gets marked up and just ticks it off, accept, or question, you know, so it's such a faster process. But there's so many different things, abstract writing, all sorts of things you can do in medical affairs as well. Then market access, we talked a little bit. Sales and marketing, lots and lots of areas, because obviously this is where I began. So we can do things like precision doctor targeting, which we do a lot of, particularly for rare disease, because they don't have that many. Well, I can give you an example of a rare one, where it was a third line cancer drug, and most patients died at second line. And so they were treating it like a rare disease because it was very rare for patients to actually survive to third line so that they could have the drug. But it also meant that it was really hard to find the doctors that would have the right patients. And so that one, we really used EHR data, electronic health record data. And so we found any patient that had ever survived to third line, even if they were dead now, and then looked at them compared with the patients that died at second line. So then we're able to identify patterns and say, okay, so out of the existing alive second line patients, which have the highest probability of surviving to third line? And so we were able to, now we don't know anything about who the patients are because of privacy, but we then triangulate that data with claims data and we can find the doctors. So we don't know the patient any details apart from this is their doctor. So then we did basically a list of all the doctors for them. We did a heat map so they could assign the reps. And that drug, they thought they'd get to 3 billion at peak sales, and we got to 3 billion within the first year because it was so targeted. They got to the exact doctors that had the right patients. So, you know, and we've done a lot of different types of things in rare disease. You know, one of the first rare disease projects we did was, it sounds a bit weird now, I don't know. So it was actually a horrible condition. It was genetic, where children were born with the condition and they would die at the age of 10 if they weren't treated. So it was really critical to get them treated quickly. But it was so rare, I think epidemiology said there are about 130 patients in the world and most of them weren't identified yet. So the company was spending so much money trying to educate doctors and 99.9% of those doctors would never see a patient ever. So I was looking at the pictures of these patients and they all had a very similar face, very similar facial features. It was a little bit syndromic. And so I said, well, we can find the patients with face recognition. That's why it doesn't sound so good now, because we've got to be very careful with face recognition now because of the AI Act. But in those days, we basically modeled a face recognition tool and put it onto Flickr. I don't even know if Flickr's still around, but Flickr was a place where you would upload photos, and Facebook. And we were able to identify pictures of children, babies, and the parents at that point had no idea that there was anything wrong with them. But then you've got the challenge, and we can talk about this too, but you've just got to be strategic. So you don't want to then go, okay, hi, your child has a disease, that condition that will kill them, and you don't even know they've got it yet. So look here, you've got to make it seem that it's a happy coincidence with AI. So we basically found out when the children were potty training was, because we talked to parents of these children, of the diagnosed ones, when they went to potty train, that's when they started to have a lot of difficulty and they realized something was wrong with the child. And they also had constantly runny noses the whole time. And so we basically did retargeting cookies. Again, we wouldn't do that today because we don't use cookies anymore, but we did retargeting cookies, which is, you know, you drop a cookie to whoever's uploaded that picture. And so then we were able to do Google ad buys where we could have a picture of a child with that condition, but we could have it matched to that child so it was aged to the same age that child would be based on when that picture was uploaded and how old they looked in that picture. So the parent, if they were searching for runny noses or potty training, it would catch their attention because it looked like there's a picture of my child and my focus at the moment is on my child. And so we got 13 new patients just like that. And that drug was around $500,000 a year per year. So it was a very expensive drug. So it was a very successful project. But more importantly, that was 13 children that would live to 60 or 70 that would have died at the age of 10. And they can live a normal life with, you know, if they're caught early, their IQ doesn't go down. If they aren't caught, by 24 months, their IQ starts going down as well. So if you catch them early, they will live and have a very normal life. So that's why I changed the business. That project alone got me so happy about the results and the lives that were impacted that that's when I started to look at, well, what are problems we can solve? Rather than just predicting market share, let's look at things that are going to impact, you know, our clients' lives and their clients, their patients and doctors' lives. So that was really cool. I love that kind of project. We do key opinion leader identification. If you do key opinion leader identification the traditional way, you're really looking at volume of publications. And it's all about who's got the most. But that doesn't mean they're impactful. And so when we've used AI to do this, we've found that roughly 50% of most pharma lists are LOLs, as we call them, loud opinion leaders, but they're not impactful. No one's taking any notice. So with those guys, you can give them the data and they'll talk about it, but you don't really have to pay them or get them on any boards. And with AI, you can also identify who are the up-and-coming doctors that aren't opinion leaders yet, but they're going to be. So really cool applications there. HCP segmentation. Nowadays, we can use big data to segment the doctors. We can create avatars of each segment. You can ask the avatars questions as if they're an actual person. We can do pre-launch planning. We've done a lot of pre-launch planning where the client, I remember one we did a lot for because it had lots of therapy areas for the same drugs. So they had a blockbuster and they didn't want to cannibalize the blockbuster, but they had two other products coming through the pipeline that were basically in all the same areas as the blockbuster. So we were able to use AI to really find the opportunity spaces and actually marketed them in completely different ways so that they both actually achieved $3 billion in their first year. One was about 2.95, I think, and the other was about 3.25. But the blockbuster, which was at $9 billion or something, didn't lose any sales. So, you know, there's lots of ways you can do it for that. And also, I think you mentioned earlier about analytics insights. One of the other things that we found for one client was they had a market access insights team. They were responsible for all products in the company. And it was, you know, top five pharma. And they were getting around 250 questions every day from the different teams. And it was really a nightmare because every question would take days to crunch the numbers and do. And so they had a team of a whole heap of guys in India as well that they were sending things to. But even so, they were so behind because there was so much. So with that one, basically the data was in really good shape and we piped it into a platform. And then the platform, anyone in the company could just type in natural language their question. And so it wasn't instant, but it would take 5 to 15 minutes. It would crunch through everything and come up with all the answers. And you could then dive into it in more depth. You could download a PowerPoint presentation that was for your boss. You know, you could do all these different things. And I remember when we finished that project, the head of that department emailed me and there were just two words and it said, game changed. And I thought, yeah, it's really good when you, it's really, you know, I love that about projects where it's so satisfying because you really made an impact in changing the way they're working. But there's just so many things, you know, whispering agents for Salesforce, lots of different Salesforce ones. There's just so many different things you can do these days.
I mean, this was a whirlwind tour of possible applications. I think, Andre, it's safe to say there's almost no area that cannot be improved by AI.
100%.
But, of course, the next question, just listening to the examples that you gave, to me is always, what about the ethical implications? I mean, on the one hand, there can be very positive ones, like if we can forego animal testing in a way that doesn't compromise our obligation to be safe, that's a huge game changer. But on the other side, of course, using data is always something that you know, triggers some anxiety in people for good reason. And then also, we don't really understand fully probably what other wide-ranging implications there could be.
I have a lot to say on this. I'll tell you where we are now, but I'll tell you where we're going. At the moment, the core considerations basically are, since GDPR, you inform consent. So if you're using someone's data, you need to give them informed consent if it's identifiable. The safety and transparency is really important. I'll start with the Belmont report. So the Belmont report is an academic report about ethics and use of data and AI. And they've got three pillars. So the first pillar is respect for people. The second one is beneficence, which is basically do no harm, like the doctor, do no harm, and maximize the possible benefits. And then the third one was justice. And so safety is really important, because there was that bit of a fiasco. IBM did that, basically an oncology treatment advisor for oncologists, but it went horribly wrong and there was a lot of issues with it. And that's the thing, you know, even if you're not trying, your intent is good, you have to make sure that you don't do harm. And that's one of the core tenets. So you've got to be so careful. And that's why this whole transparency in white box AI has come about now, because a lot of AI was black box. You knew it was working, but you didn't quite know why it was making its decisions. Whereas now we've got a lot of focus on, well, what's the reason? What's the rationale for this? And then algorithmic fairness and bias. And every project I've ever done with AI, this is the biggest part, is that data wrangling part, as we call it. Making sure the data is clean, making sure that it is fair and representative sample. Because if there's any bias in the data, it gets amplified with AI. So there's a great example of that from Amazon a few years ago. I think it was around 2017, but I'm not sure, where they put AI on their recruitment. And so they put all these resumes in and they trained it, and then they left the AI to hire people. And so they're hiring all these great people. And then one day they said, we haven't hired a woman in a long time. And so they went and looked at the data, and all the resumes in there were men. So then they went back and they took off the gender field, and it still kept hiring men. And they realized that men and women actually have very different language in their resumes. So until they put female resumes in the system, it kept being biased and amplifying that bias. So that's really important. And then the other one, of course, is data privacy and security. Healthcare data is the most hacked data out there. It's really, I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was hundreds of millions of healthcare records every year get hacked. It's a huge area. In the UK, I think it was around 2017 as well, the NHS, a whole heap of NHS hospitals got hacked. And for 2 days, and I'm pretty sure they probably paid the ransom, they couldn't do anything. It basically brought these hospitals to their knees. There was no data because it was all locked up with these hackers. So it's a big area for hacking. And so really making sure that your data is secure and private is a really big thing. But I don't think any of this is going to be a problem soon because I don't think we're going to be using much human data in the future. I think most data that we will be using is synthetic or digital twin data. I really don't think humans and human data will be used. And that makes a lot of sense for our industry to use synthetic data because, you know, you've got all the elements that make it as real as if it is a human, but it's not actually anyone. It's just fake data. And if that fake data is good enough, which it is now, I mean, even the FDA are approving it fake synthetic data, then we don't need to use humans.
I think there's no corner of kind of the biopharma industry where AI doesn't either have an application today or one we can foresee in the future. But this whole idea of using synthetic data, so I think there's a few things here that are coming together. There's the speed of, let's say, clinical development and time to market, which is
60 to 70% speed reduction in cost and increase in speed is everything I've researched.
Yeah. And to put that in some context, depending on whose numbers you believe, it maybe costs $1 billion to $2.6 billion to bring a drug to market if you fully load it with all the drugs that didn't make it. So big numbers. So if you're significantly reducing time and then the costs associated with that, there's a lot of implications there. And maybe we'll get drugs that otherwise wouldn't, the economics didn't make it feasible to bring it to market. And all of a sudden, some of these compounds that might have been left on the shelf or in the lab now can make it to market and actually benefit patients.
The drugs could be cheaper as well.
Yeah, and less expensive, faster, hopefully taking out some of the complexity or concerns around patient privacy and not putting maybe as many patients at risk. There are risks when humans enter clinical trials. But here's my question. Looking forward into that future state that sounds so attractive, how do we validate that, though? Ultimately, we're depending on all this synthetic data and machines to make all these decisions for us. Hopefully, they're making the right decisions, but they're not perfect. They're not infallible. And so are we going to depend, I'm just wondering what your opinion is on this, are we depending on real-world evidence post-launch to kind of validate that? Or what are the steps that would be the necessary layer of safety for all of us before the general public starts consuming medications that have only been in kind of this synthetic AI environment previously?
I feel that it's probably more validated with synthetic data than with human data because you can run it on hundreds of thousands of patients as opposed to a small sample. And with all AI, you train it and iterate and iterate and iterate for accuracy. So, you know, you do it till you've got 100% accuracy. Then you put more data in, it goes down to 89. And you put it, gets it back up to 100, and then you go down. So it's actually got huge amounts of iterations that increase the accuracy. I suspect humans will always be, maybe not always, but in the coming decade, still be quite skeptical and still require a human in part of the trial. But once we get the digital twins, and I had a woman who's doing research into all sorts of issues in pregnancy and maternal death and fetal death, and she is using digital twins. Obviously, it's a great area because you don't want to be giving pregnant women drugs. And I said to her, and she's a professor in the US, and I said to her, you know, you're doing all this stuff with digital twins. How long do you think it's going to be before everyone in the Western world, at least, can access our own digital twin? And she said, I think it's in 10 years. And that seems amazing. But actually, when I see the speed of what's going on with AI right now, I can see that's entirely possible. And so when everyone has a digital twin, then that data is all validated on you all the time. Like that's what, you know, Medtronic and device companies do with artificial insulin pumps. That's actually, the insulin pump is a digital twin. And so it's basically taking readings. It's been created with thousands of people's bodies, pancreases in this case, but it's taking readings of blood readings from that person all the time. And it's basically twinning your pancreas for your conditions. And so that's basically what digital twins do. It has your data and it's basically making it the same reading back and forth with your data. So I think that it will be actually pretty accurate with the digital twins in particular. There's a lot going on in that space. And I feel like the way, and I don't know, haven't even started on organs on a chip and biohybrids yet, but I feel like the way things are going, the pharma industry of the future will be basically super fast bench to market because all of that can be sped up. A lot of the stuff, medical affairs, regulatory, will all be easily automated, already is easy to automate. You still need a human in the loop, but it will be a much faster process, a lot of these things. And the sales and marketing will be much more automated as well. But what will be interesting is with all the advances in precision medicine and the fact that we could probably test a drug on our digital twin before we get the dosage. So there's 3D printers, obviously, that print drugs now. And they're printing biologics. So the way I see it going is that the pharma companies probably won't be doing manufacturing in the future. They will probably be supplying the active ingredients, coming up with the discovery with AI, supplying the active ingredients to a pharmacy. The pharmacies will have 3D printers and then it will be the formulation will be tested on our digital twin. So our exact dosage will be determined, and then that gets printed at the pharmacy for us. So that's the way I see it going.
Amazing. Yeah.
Fascinating. We're at the end of our hour, which went by way too fast. There are so many questions I still have for you, Andre, but we'll have to save those for another day. We'll have another conversation in the near future, and things will have already changed and improved and accelerated. Again, especially, it would be nice to have you come back on a panel, maybe with Dr. Art Kaplan, who's a bioethicist, and some other people. You can all discuss things from your respective perspectives. But we'll just close out with a question that we ask all of our esteemed guests, which is there a person or a motto or an event that has shaped your professional career, which has been so interesting? I think you have a red thread going through everything, but you have such a multifaceted career. What is your guiding star here?
I guess I like to innovate. I get frustrated when I see things being done in inefficient and old-fashioned ways when they could be done in better ways. Why I didn't want to be an academic was because I wanted to see real-world impact. And doing that first rare disease project where we save children's lives, that kind of changed a lot of what I wanted to do. I really wanted to make sure that the sorts of things that were being done were actually impacting real people, which is quite really rewarding.
Amazing. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And this has been such an interesting conversation. I think we could take any one of these areas that we've identified and probably do an hour on each of them, because they're all their own thing with different tools and different applications and different economics behind them.
Yes.
So this was a great broad overview, and we'd love in the future for you to come back and maybe dive a little deeper in some of these areas so we can continue to learn more. And I think this will continue to evolve, obviously, and hopefully positive ways.
Yeah. No, well, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks so much. Wow. Well, that time with Dr. Bates really flew by, and I feel like we just scratched the surface on some of this stuff. She was kind of getting into areas that I hadn't even thought of where AI may have an application. Made sense to me, and there's only upside. It's so exciting. I mean, really, AI hasn't been on my radar screen significantly, except for the last, let's say, year and a half or so when OpenAI started coming out with ChatGPT. And of course, now I find myself using that almost daily. It's hard to imagine where we're going to be 3, 5, or 10 years out from now. But my takeaway is that it is really a turning point, even beyond biopharma, but certainly within our industry, of how we use these tools.
I agree. We didn't have time to go into any sort of detail on any of these potential uses. And I think that just shows how omnipresent AI really has become. And I'm glad that Andre mentioned some areas that I've been thinking about as potential pain points, to be honest. And it's good to know that AI can maybe provide some solutions here where we really save time and money. And even more than that, right? We talked about the animal testing. We talked about patients not having to go through the screening process and the whole process of being in a clinical trial, which we cannot underestimate of that is still a burden on patients. But of course, we still want to make progress, and we still want to make sure that patients' needs are met. So it seems like a very good solution. I have to say, though, when she told us some of these stories and anecdotes, it did make my hair stand up a little bit, because the ethical implications are just always at the forefront of my mind when it comes to AI or big data, and not even necessarily AI, but anytime when your data goes into some black hole and you really don't know where it goes, potentially, even if all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, somebody could hack it. She mentioned that as well. And we've had a few high profile instances of that where, with 23andMe or in Finland, mental health provider were hacked and your data is out there and it's being used to blackmail people. It's being used to hold like the NHS hostage. So it's never really all the positive parts of AI that I think about. It's always, I almost feel like we need a mandatory ethicist and compliance officer attached to whoever starts thinking about the usage of big data.
But I think those challenges always go hand in hand with technological innovation. And so we'll always be managing that. We'll always be finding problems and hopefully solving them. If you think back just in the recent past, some of the concerns we have right now around privacy were certainly brought up when the World Wide Web was in its infancy and all the things that went along with that. And we're still managing that, certainly. I just, you know, want to make sure that that doesn't get in the way of advancement. We just have advance in the right way. And, you know, something that stood out to me is, we talked about the synthetic data, which was really interesting, but the digital clones is still an ethical issue in my mind, right? Because it's still you, right? It's a digital representation of you out there.
The digital twins?
The digital twin, sorry, yeah. And so, you know, do you want your insurance company to have access to that and understand everything there is to know about you and your risk factors? And so I think there still are some nuances and ethical complexities around this. I'm sure we have bright people working on it, but it's great to see that these advances really are bringing value to us, let's say in the business world, but certainly to patients as well.
Yeah, I mean, advancement will happen. It's just a matter of how do we manage it? And I don't think we've ever had this level of detail, the amount of data. I think that truly is unprecedented. So the considerations that we have to make are also unprecedented.
Another great episode, fun conversation. Thanks so much, Nari. I really look forward to next time.
Me too. Thanks, Ian. And that's a wrap on today's episode of Real Pharma. We hope our dose of pharmaceutical discourse has left you in good spirits and has increased your titers of knowledge.
Absolutely. If you found today's pill-packed adventure as stimulating as a shot of epinephrine, we'd love for you to show us some brand loyalty.
Yes, drop us a like and leave a review. It's the best prescription for podcast success.
Think of your review as the little booster shot that keeps our show in tip-top shape.
And hey, don't just keep us as your secret remedy. Share the good vibes and let others in on our Real Pharma therapeutic sessions.
So hit that review button like it's the perfect cure for a long commute. Your feedback is the treatment that keeps us going.
Thanks for tuning in. And remember, an episode a day keeps the boredom away.
Stay curious, stay healthy, and keep this podcast prescription handy for biopharma stories and insights.
See you next time.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. Please visit us at realpharma.co for more valuable resources. Real Pharma is brought to you by Black Canyon Ventures.